Well, hi everybody, my name's Sandy Beecher and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? Well, here we are back again. I hope you're having as much fun as I am. This is very enjoyable for me because I love telling stories. And that's what this has turned into, so I hope you like hearing stories and we'll just keep going till I run out. And then I'll have to get back to the steps. And we've said that on at the beginning of each of these, that this is not a workshop or Joe and Charlie or how to do the 12 steps of AA. But rather, this is just somebody who's been around a long time and has some stories about AA and some thoughts about what the steps mean spiritually and what the picture of the whole deal might look like. And so that's what I'm going to keep on doing, and I've been happy so far with how it's been going. And generally, I've been starting with some stories about the early AA. And last week, we were talking about one of the great characters in AA, Clarence Snyder. And I didn't really finish with him because I think I got where he was out in Cleveland and started an inner group and written pamphlets and how to sponsor people and how forward he was compared to the rest of the country even. I mean, Cleveland had so many people sober that it was a natural target for the first international convention because they knew they could get lots of people to come. As a matter of fact, they had the 10th anniversary conference in Cleveland. It wasn't an international conference, but they got 3,000 or 4,000 people to show up in 1945. And I'm sure that the main guy behind that was probably Clarence. That, all right, let's get them all here to Cleveland. And I wish they had some talks from there. Maybe they do. I'll have to ask Lee. But anyway, after and I forgot to mention that Clarence, these people that I talk about, I generally am referencing their story in the big book. And Clarence's story is the brewmeister. And it was in the first, I think it was in the first two editions, and then I don't know if it's in this time or not. And he got the title for that. That hardly described his life, which was, as you heard, drinking whiskey and being out on the road and with trucks and really just getting sick as a dog. But way back when he first got married, and his wife had gotten pregnant, the doctor told Clarence that a glass of beer once in a while might be good for his wife. So being a good husband, he decided to set up his own brewery in the house with the home brew, and started with something about this big, and there wasn't any left for her to have a glass, so he had to get a bigger container of homebrew, and I don't know if she ever got a glass, but he got an awful lot of beer and started having parties at his house, and that went on for a number of years until he found out that whiskey got you there a lot quicker, and you didn't have to pour down 48 ounces of liquid. You could just use that beer as a chaser. And that became the thing for the future. But after a while, Clarence moved to St. Pete, Florida, and spent a lot of time over here as the elder statesman in AA with the most time of anybody. So he was in big demand to go around and speak, to do workshops, to do step studies, and he did that for year after year after year. And right before he died, maybe about 5 or 6 years, he met a lady and they got married and went over towards Orlando, Castleberry, and that's where he spent his final days. And the retreats, I don't know if they're still going on, but the retreats that he, are they? Yeah. The retreats that he organized were really popular all over the country. People with long-term sobriety would come, especially from areas that I'll talk about in a minute, which we already covered, but areas where spirituality wasn't emphasized as much as other areas. And so there was this psychological approach up in New York and part of New England, and then there was the Christian approach out of Akron. And so the people that came through that influence had a much heavier dose of spirituality in the steps. And so, you know, they just saw that the people who didn't have the heavy dose of spirituality were looking at the people that did. And they were going, why is that guy happier than I am? We both have 20 years. And we both have the same kind of income. And we both have a house. And why is he, who walks around happy all the time? What the heck is going on? And that sort of led to, well, maybe I've got to dig a little deeper here and take my program to another level. And so that was, there would be new people, but there were also lots of people who had some time that went to Clarence's retreats. And over the years, it's been said that the retreats were religious, but they really weren't. He was very careful to divide them into two parts. There was the AA part, which stayed strictly with the literature, the steps, etc. And then when that was over, you had a chance to leave if you want, because now we're going to be saved by Jesus. And so, but that was always part of Clarence's deal. And he wouldn't back off. He wouldn't stop talking about that. And he wouldn't stop breaking his anonymity. He said, the traditions weren't around when I got sober, so why the hell should I care about them? And I don't know, but some of it may have been that the traditions came out of New York. And if you recall, there was the pull and tug from New York and Akron. And so he really made a wonderful contribution. And while I'm on the subject of New York and Akron, it was kind of funny that there was a series of coincidences. One was a very powerful guy in New York was Jim Burwell, who was a former atheist and very big in getting it started there, and then helped Fitz in Washington, D.C., and then Philadelphia. And so his influence was pretty strong, and he wasn't trying to make it a non-spiritual program. What he wanted was to fake out the new alcoholics by leading them to believing it was a psychological program, and so we'll push the God stuff way down the end. And then after we got them here a while, then we'll tell them about the spirituality. And his theory was that it would widen the net and would get more people to come in and in the long run reach more alcoholics. Whether that's true or not, I have no idea. But that was the thinking behind it. And just sort of following that suit, the Oxford group in New York was starting to get tired of the alcoholics, whereas the Oxford group in Akron didn't want them to leave. As the inevitable became real, that there were so many new people who were alcoholics that the rest of the Oxford groupers were feeling outnumbered, because, you know, us alcoholics, we're recruiting and we're out there finding more people to come. And so when Bill was holding little separate meetings in his home on Clinton Street in Brooklyn, and also they would meet at a cafeteria after the Oxford group. The Oxford group people, I don't know if they went home, the rest of them, but the alcoholics would all hang together and go out for coffee and a sandwich like we do today. Must be something about being an alcoholic that after a meeting you got to go get some coffee and an ice cream or something. Anyway, the Oxford group was trying to get the meetings at Bill's house in the cafeteria stopped. And they were putting a lot of pressure on the alcoholic members of the Oxford group to stop going there because they were less than 100%, which was the term they used. You're not doing this 100%. Whereas in Akron, it was very difficult for Dr. Bob to even consider leaving because they had such dear friends in the Oxford group out there, especially the Williams, who gave them their home to hold the meetings. And so it really was all the way up into 1940 before they finally moved to Dr. Bob's house and then down to the King Street School, where there's still a meeting on Wednesday nights if you go out in Akron. And that's the meeting that came from Dr. Bob's house. Now, in addition to those people, there's we very often hear about Sister Ignatia. And I see Beth from Akron, and she knows the history better than I do. But anyway, we hear a lot about Sister Ignatia, this wonderful Catholic nun from Ireland, who was at the St. Thomas Hospital in Akron and was very interested in helping alcoholics and had actually helped some before Dr. Bob got sober. She had another doctor who was smuggling him into the place where they sell flowers in the hospital, and it put a cot back in there. So, because if the administration knew, you got what in there? A drunk? We don't want drunks in the hospital. They throw up and bother the other patients, and so we can't have them in here. But she was their defender, and of course, when Dr. Bob came along, they were a natural pair to start this alcohol approach, and she ended up with a special place in Akron for alcoholics, and it was a 5-day deal, just like Dr. Bob. That's how long it took to dry out and get told about spirituality, and the Oxford group members would come and see the drunk, and they were turning out lots of drunks. And what she gave them as they were leaving, and she called them in very privately and said, "I want to give you this Sacred Heart medallion," which is a very Catholic thing. And it is made out of felt, generally, and there's a little picture of a heart, a bleeding heart, and it's the Sacred Heart medallion. And she gave it to them to keep in their pocket, much like our coins today. It was the predecessor of keeping some your good luck charm in your pocket. And she told them and looked at them right in the eye, and she said, "If you're going to take a drink, you have to bring this back to me first." And she said it in such a strong fashion that it was really hard for alcoholics to take that first drink with that thing in their pocket. And they go, "God damn, Sister Ignatius will find out about this, and she'll talk to the people up there, and I'll be in trouble no matter what happens." And so she had a big effect on that, and thousands of people got that who were from all religions, but they got that little Sacred Heart medallion in their pocket. And in around 1950, a little after that, after Dr. Bob died, the Catholic Church transferred her to Cleveland, where she set up a very exact replica of what she had done in Akron. And she named it Rosary Hall Solarium. Not sanitarium. Rosary Hall Solarium, after Dr. Bob's initials, RHS. And did the same thing there with thousands of alcoholics. With the 5 days, she had a name for each day. You know, eventually it was inventory acceptance, and then a plan, a moral inventory, and then a plan for the future as you went out the last day. And AA was there, and they got sponsors and all of that. But she was a major contributor. I think she died in the 60s to us. And one other that I want to mention tonight was a man who joined the Oxford group up in Massachusetts in 1923, and his name was Jim Newton. And while he was there and in the New York area, he became very good friends with Frank Buckman, who started the Oxford group, and Sam Shoemaker, the minister of the church in New York, that's where Bill went. And Roland Hazard, who we talked about earlier, went to see Dr. Young. And another guy named Shep Cornell, who is in the Big Book. He was one of the early guys and was one of the people who got Ebbie Thatcher away from the judge and brought him into the Oxford group. So he already knew some of the key players in AA, only he didn't know they were key players. And we find this throughout all of AA history, that there's this gathering or this accumulation of people like Bill and all the other people who were summering in Manchester, Vermont, and then because they knew each other as youngsters, they grew up, and there was the founder of Al-Anon and the co-founder of AA, all and Ebbie and the whole nine yards. So anyway, Burwell was asked to move to Florida, to Fort Myers, to work for Thomas Edison. And he was a very good executive assistant and organizer, but he also was trying to make some money in real estate, and he had a real estate license. And, of course, Edison hung around with all the big shots in America, and one of them was Harvey Firestone, the Firestone Rubber Company out in Akron. And he was down in Fort Myers and was talking. He says, you know, I need a special executive secretary. You know anybody be good for that? And he said, yeah, Jim here. He would be perfect. And I guess there was a good pay raise, so Jim packed up his bags from Fort Myers and went on out to Akron, Ohio. And after there a while, he made friends with Firestone's children. There were six children, and one of them, Bud Firestone, was a raging alcoholic. And the father was doing everything he could to get him sober, and nothing was working. And so one time he sent him off to whatever hospital or treatment they were doing back then, and Jim Newton went with him to see if he could help out. And on the way back, he was not doing well, got drunk, and so he said, why don't you come with me? I'm going to an Episcopal conference somewhere, and I want you to meet some people. And he was thinking of the fact that the Oxford group had sobered up some alcoholics, and maybe it would work for this guy. And so on the train back, he had Sam Shoemaker was at the convention, and so they talked to him. And before he got back to Akron, he was saved and joined the Oxford movement. They had to go elsewhere to go to meetings, but he did join that. And then he gets sober, and he's doing well, and his father is watching this. And he said, what happened to you? He said, I got in the Oxford group. Well, what's that? Well, it's all over the place. We don't have it here, but it's all over the place. It's really big, and it's helping people all over. So his father said, well, let's bring it here. And so phone calls were made to Frank Buckman, and it's going to be a major event. The newspapers are covering it, you know, and the top dog is going to organize something. So it's at the Mayflower Hotel, and Jim Newton had joined an Episcopal church there. It was the same one that the Firestones went to. And the minister, whose name is all over our AA history, was Reverend Walter Tunks. And he was asked to host the Oxford thing. And so into town comes the entourage, and there's an awful lot of publicity going out in Akron. Come and attend one of these Oxford things. Firestone is all excited. This is going to be a wonderful thing for Akron. And attending that meeting, because of all the publicity, was Ann Smith and Henrietta Seiberling. And the Williams, Henry T. Henry and Clarice Williams, whose home was used for all the meetings. And so the reason that Newton's name is brought into all of this is, without him, the Oxford group may have never gotten to Akron. And if it hadn't gotten to Akron, then Ann Smith wouldn't have been able to tell her husband about it. And Henrietta Seiberling wouldn't be available, knowing all about Dr. Bob's problem, as he attended on a regular basis. And Reverend Tunks, whose name was in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel under the church directory, wouldn't have been called into play when Bill Wilson was sitting there thinking about having a drink. And he looked over at that church directory and said, maybe I can find some alcoholic to help me. Called up Reverend Tunks. Reverend Tunks said, oh, yeah, we can get you. He got one guy who got him in touch with Henrietta Seiberling. And then she called Ann Smith and set up the meeting with Bill. And then they all met in the Williams home. So you can just see that all the players came together when Firestone said, we're going to have a big deal in Akron. And so Newton kind of played a very key role without realizing it in getting us started. And so that brings us pretty much through the 40s. World War II came along. AA stayed sober in great numbers. And you see that in the tradition when he's talking about the people in Alaska or Salerno beachhead. They just had a thing on the History Channel about the Japanese invasion of Alaska, the Aleutian Islands, and that was the first time American territory had been occupied by foreigners, and it lasted a while. It was quite a deal getting them out of there. So anyway, next week, and Bill is starting to write the traditions, and so next week we'll start around the 1950 and talk about the traditions and the first convention and some of the things that happened as we move along in time. So maybe we'll just follow a time frame. So moving back to the spirituality of this program and the frame of reference that I've been using, it's really been helpful to me, which was to start at the end. But if, you know, in other words, what's this whole deal about? Well, let me tell you the ending. You know, I know that people hate that when you go to a movie. What's the ending? But sometimes it can be useful in understanding what we're trying to accomplish as we move through all the steps. And the ending is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message about a spiritual awakening to the next person. So there's a tremendous emphasis on this profound personality change called the spiritual awakening. Because it's in that transformation that it becomes real easy to not drink. That is why AA is so successful. It's because without alcohol, we have found a way to see the world as a very friendly place to live. And I don't know about you all, but I did not see the world that way. That's why I drank. The world was frightening. It made no sense. I saw no purpose in life. I was a loner. I didn't know what people were up to. I just saw greed, and I guess you got to make a lot of money. I don't know what's going on. Give me a drink. And then I found a place to live that was wonderful. And it was the world of three drinks. And in that place, I was as happy as could be. I wasn't wanting anything. It was just a lovely place to be. Unfortunately, I didn't stay at drink number three. I tried to improve on nirvana. And ended up in jail. You know what happens when... But I swore the next night I'm going to stay at the three level. Never could do that. And I know I'm not the only one that tried. Tonight, I'm just going to stay at the three level. So anyway, when we take alcohol out of the equation, we're left feeling pretty bad. And we're going to stay this way. I mean, we don't drink a day at a time, and life is lived a day at a time, but our ego is telling us, yeah, but some of these people are thinking of staying sober forever. Yeah, I guess they are. That's a long time to feel the way I do. How could I feel this way forever? I can't feel this way for another month. I'll be lucky to last another. So it's clear something has to be done about how we're feeling and how what's going on inside of us. That's what the awakening is. That's the, wow, is that nice? That's the answer. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, as Bill had a rapid one, and the rest of us have to be content with gradual change. But eventually, even ourselves, we realize, wow, what they've been talking about is real. I can feel it inside. And we each have our own connection with our Creator. And that is what we maintain in order, or increase, in order to not go back to drinking. So we talked about surrendering and coming to grips with the fact that we have a situation that only a source of spiritual power can address. So out of sheer necessity, we have to change our minds about a higher power. Not because anybody proved it to us or showed us one. We were just shown the plain truth about our situation. Hard, cold facts. Unless there's a higher power, it's over. Now, we didn't want to hear that. Well, no, it's not. I'm not that bad. I'm not so bad I need a higher power. That's horrible to be that bad off that you need a... Isn't that funny that we would think that way? God, I hope I never need a higher power. And then when we find out what happens, we're so glad. But I didn't know what it was all about, and it seemed to me like that's the last thing I want. A higher power coming in, messing around in my life? How do I know what'll happen? And my sponsor would point to the wristband from the nut ward and go, well, maybe better, I don't know. It was no winning with him, because he would never talk theory, only talked results. And I never could win. I couldn't, I was so far behind the power curve trying to earn money and come out. And he just kept saying, you just keep following the plan. And I'm glad he did. So we talked about how that inventory was so important that we had two steps for that. And we used the story, and people have told me during the week that they really found it helpful to view the inventory from a slide projector point of view. And just reviewing that, the way humans operate is to look out at the world and try to fulfill what's missing inside of them by rearranging what's out there. Get some money away from that guy and move it over towards me. You follow what I'm saying? And then I'll get a pilot's license, and then I'll be up there, so I'll move out of this into an airplane. You see what I mean? And so we're moving, and things keep getting in the way. You know what I mean? Well, that guy got it. Now, then this guy. Now, what happened to this? And then, well, what the hell? Why was my insurance canceled? You're ruining my plan that I'm trying to lay out up there. And then I get up in the morning, I'm feeling halfway decent, and I read the paper, and now I'm totally depressed because I'm hearing about all the things out there that are screwed up, and now I feel depressed. I shouldn't have read that damn thing. So we had no way of knowing that that isn't where the game can be won. that it's an inside job. We should have had a clue from drinking that the name of the game was an inside job, that you fixed inside here and everything changes out there. And so that's the point of inventorying, is to take our focus away from the world as we see it. Because what I'm seeing is what I'm putting together in my slide projector. I'm making lots of slides and I'm putting them in there, and then I'm looking up there and I'm not liking what I see. Well, I made it. I'm the guy who put it together. Because these things are made by thinking. So whatever thoughts I'm thinking up, I'm seeing that. If I sit here and think, you know, the world really sucks. I haven't had a break in 10 years. I'm going to do that with my eyes shut. Now I open my eyes. What do I see? I see the world sucks and you don't get a break for 10 years. It's right there. It's clear as a bell. I can point it out to everybody. See that guy? He's got a break. He's doing all right. See that? See that? There. True. Now the guy sitting next to me, he told himself, you know, everything's really cool. I'm pretty happy with everything. And then he looks up, same stuff. And he says to me, isn't that great? And I go, what the hell are you talking about? That's not great. That's terrible. I never saw the connection between what I was doing. And I'm doing it by thinking. Thinking. That is the obsession with every human being. What do you want to do about that? I got to think about it. I got to think about it. Well, how long do you think you'll think about it? Oh, man, I don't know. It could be a couple of weeks. I got to think about it. So I go in my bedroom and stay up all night making about 2,000 slides. So that I can keep looking at them. And, well, it's worse than I thought. I got to think about it more. I got to think about it some more. So everything, and we're going to find out that spirituality really is not about getting anything. It's about getting rid of stuff. It's about getting rid of everything that we created, which is our ideas. That's why Bill writes, old ideas have failed us nothing. Let's inventory all of them and get rid of them. And so we have a plan for that, and it was laid out in the step last week of how to categorize all the different ideas and emotions that we have, which are resentments and fears and sex drive, and the accompanying problems that come out of that according to us, because that's where all problems come from. Bill talked about our problems we think are of our own making. So we have created inside a projection booth with a million slides, and we just keep sticking them in and looking and going, oh, jeez. When is it ever going to straighten out? As if so, and then we leave and go up to the thing and try to move it on the screen. It would be like you're at the movie trying to move something on the movie screen. I'm tired of that guy always winning. Get off the screen. Well, you can't get him off up there. You can't affect anything up there. So now we finally we go, all right, well, if we go in here, stop worrying about the world, stop doing anything, leave all the problems unattended. This is the quickest way to solve them. Leave them all unattended. No one even guarding them. You know what I mean? Some of us almost feel like if we're going to leave our problems alone, we need someone to watch over them. You know what I mean? Because what if they're gone when I come back to them? I mean, if this is true. if somehow we could work magic and take everybody, all of the problems that everybody has in this room, who would you be? That'd be a panic attack. What would I think about? Nothing. In other words, there's such a part of who we are that deep down there's part of us that's just terrified of getting rid of them all, because what would be left? Completely unknown. Completely unknown. What would be there? And that's what we're going to find out. That's what we're going to find out in this process of getting ourselves out of the way. We say that we're a spiritual being having a human experience. What if we can get all this human energy out of the way? What do you suppose would feel? What do we suppose would then be looking at the world? Would we, in fact, be seeing what we were supposed to see before we made up the big story that is our own drama? Before I made up the drama that I star in, you notice everyone in this room is the center of all your problems. That's, they happen to you or they're not a problem. My closest friend loses his job. I go, man, that's really rough, but it's not a problem for me. That's his problem. You follow what I'm saying? So anyway, we came to this idea that let's go inside. See, when I took that inventory, I said, what am I doing this for? I got stuff to do out here. I got to get some money. I can't be fooling around with this kind of stuff. This is time consuming. I got problems to think about. I got to fill out this sheet. Could take hours. And I don't have hours free from problem worrying. So now you can see we're never going to go back to that. This is a new way of life. We're going to unlearn all of the old ways that we saw things and that we lived. And so we're going to go inside of the slide projector and we're going to inventory all the stock that's in there. And we're going to throw out stuff that really would be inappropriate to keep. And as we make the list of the inventory in there, what we got, we notice that the word rationalization appears all over the place. Rationalize, 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 rationalize. Now, if we rationalize a lot, do you think our inventory is any good at all? How do we know what we put down here as an honest appraisal of ourselves is of any value whatsoever? Maybe we should run all this by someone else. Someone else? Run my life by someone else? What the hell are you talking about? I don't run my life by anybody else. And so we have this fifth step. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. And so as we get started with this higher power thing, sometimes it's not that uncomfortable to say, well, yeah, all right, well, God, this is this, and this is this, and this is that. And then we say, well, he already knows this anyway. So that's not really a difficult thing to do. I think I'll make the fifth step a two-part thing. Admit to myself and to God the exact nature of my wrongs. That really seems sufficient. But that isn't. This, what's coming up here, is one of the greatest principles in our program. And that is, it's impossible to see the truth about yourself alone. People, and this is the step where Bill writes, people of very high spiritual development insist on checking with others the guidance they feel they may have gotten from their Creator. So if people of very high spiritual development always check with other people, maybe we really should. And that's where our sponsor or whoever is going to help us with this project comes in. And they are brought in to help us see as we bring up each slide or as you go through the list. And we look at it and we go, all right, I have a resentment about this. Here's this thing. Well, I can project it. Yeah, this is what happened. See her? She's doing that. And then this guy, see, he comes in. And then I'm the one that gets screwed. You can see it. It's right there. No wonder I have a resentment. There's no, I had no part in that, right? You can see it. I can see it. It's clear as a bell. And the sponsor's going, well, no, you actually have four resentments to make as a result of your part in that. What? I don't see it that way. That's the point. I don't see it that way. And it's amazing as we go through each one of these slides and put it up there for our sponsor to see how he doesn't see it the same way that I see it. He sees it from the big picture. He sees it in terms of everybody. I see it in terms of me. You know what I'm saying? It's amazing how I only see how it might affect me. And so we need another person to bring out the third dimension in all of this. And in the beginning, it's painful because it means you're wrong. This is like the death knell to the ego. For an alcoholic to admit that he or she is wrong in the beginning, when we first come to AA, is like turning the Queen Mary around in Tampa Harbor over here. It's going to take about 15 tugboats. What are you doing? I'm getting him to change his mind. And I remember telling my sponsor, okay, you're right. He said, no, you're wrong. Oh. Bill, it's the same thing. Well, say it. I'll tell you, that those words stuck in my throat. I'm wrong. Do you know how hard that was to say? Oh yeah, I'm wrong. I can't hear you. Wrong. You know what is so exciting now? Is if I find something I'm wrong about and can get rid of it. Oh boy, I just found something else I'm wrong about. Boom, gone. That's the 10th step. That's Chuck Chamberlain. Uncover, discover, discard. Oh boy, something else wrong. Boom, gone. But in the beginning, it is such a... It just shatters you to be wrong. I don't know about you, but it just killed me. All right, we got through one item. And it's all right. I'm wrong. I see your point. I did have a role. Yeah. I get... Okay. I had a small... I actually caused it now that I see what's going on. I never would have seen that on my own. Whew. I'm glad that's over. Well, let's go to the next slide. Oh, you know. You don't think I could be wrong on this one too, do you? Well, let's put it up. Well, yeah, that's the one with my father. Now, you can see, it was clear my father was very unfair to me. You can see all that. I had no part in that, right, Bill? I caused that, too. All right. And so it's just amazing. Now, in the beginning, you feel terrible. I'm wrong. But every time you're wrong, it's like somebody pulled a thistle or a thorn out of your skin. Wrong, gone. And you start getting into it, and you go, you know, being wrong has some advantages. You feel better afterwards. Wrong. And then I start looking where I might be wrong on what I have done. I'm starting to actually complete that inventory with a different perspective. It's good to see your part in it. It's great to try and understand them and give them the benefit of the doubt. Wow, I'm getting a new way of seeing things. One item at a time. We're adjusting the picture. And each one seems like a painful little wrong. But slowly, we're moving these slides, throwing them out, and a new picture is coming in. And as we will see, as we get further along, an awakening, our promises, we'll talk about those, they accurately describe what it looks like when you finish this process. And as you finish it and see up on the screen, wow, a major change in the world and the people who live in it. A major change. You look out and go, I never really would have seen the world this way. And I never would have seen people this way. There's a lot of nice people. As a matter of fact, there's tons of nice people. Where were they hiding before? Where were they hiding before? Well, they were reacting to me. Because my old view of things caused me to see them as competitors, as people who are in my way of getting what would make me happy. And so the whole picture slowly gets changed to the point that we have a whole tail end of the program to maintain or improve that picture. Maintain or improve it. Maintain our spiritual condition out of the 10th step. So we've had some fun here with this, and another story that, and I'll just wrap up with one more story because that's all I got to say on that step, is the importance of bringing somebody else in the booth and start throwing those slides out, and even the ones you thought you ought to save. People like the story I told my granddaughter about the goddess with the 6 billion hairs and so on down, and brought all the hairs to a movie show here on planet Earth. It's the greatest show in town. And so she called me about a month ago and asked me to refresh her memory. And she said, was that the only movie that they ever got to see? And I said, oh, no. They changed movies all the time. The best one, the favorite one prior to that, was when the dinosaurs were here. And he brought them all down to watch the dinosaurs. And it went on for the longest time. They set up this whole theater about 65 million years ago. And all these hares got to come down and just watch dinosaurs and all the creatures that were in existence at that time. And when it came time for the end of the show, they simply announced that the show had completed its run. And it's time to turn the dinosaur costumes in backstage. And we're going to have to strike the set. So they called a meteor in and struck the set. And the entire theater, I mean, you'd never know the show was here, except for a few remnants down below. And they started building the show that's going on now. And they're both wonderful. And if my memory was any good, I could probably remember the dinosaur show. It was on TV, if I recall. No, that was the dinosaur show. But anyway, she gets a big kick out of it. And why does she get a kick out of it? Because she's a little kid. That's why she gets a big kick out of it. Now, when adults listen to somebody telling a story to a little kid, they can pretend that they're a little kid and enjoy it. I do that all the time. I just go, God. And there's such a wonderful perspective to be childlike. There just isn't that many things to get so serious about. I hope those of you that are new are going to understand that as the years go on, our goal is to never work on our problems. Let them go. Let them go. Let me close with this. If we see suddenly all kinds of problems, where should we go to work on them? In the projection booth. We let them all go up there and go back in the projection booth. What's going on in here? Oh, I don't know. I found some old slides that we forgot to show out. Oh, I see. Well, then now that we're showing those, it'll always be in here. Always. It'll look like it's out there, and we'll be suckered in to going back up, messing around with the screen. All right, well, this one is different. I constantly have problems where my ego gets me during the night. I wish I didn't have to sleep. Because that's when he gets me and comes in, and I wake up, and he's got this big bad news stuff. Listen, before you get going, I want to talk to you about a bunch of stuff. What? We got to do this, and they're going to crap all over you. Get out the door. Get going. Get out. What? I'm not awake yet. Get out of bed. Get over there. They're going to get you today. Okay. I said, well, wait a minute. Maybe I ought to pray about it. No. These problems, this little group right here, are exceptions to the steps. Really? I didn't know we had problems. These three. Now, I want you to get dressed. I want you to go out. Handle these on your own. Don't call your sponsor. Don't call any friends. Get them. Go! And then we see that person at a meeting then, and I go, what's wrong? I got suckered by my ego. I got the same old con game. Hey, buddy, want to buy it? So anyway, with each other, maybe we can stay off the screen and come on back inside. We're at the end of the time. I've had a wonderful time myself tonight, and I hope you all have too. And we'll... We'll wrap it up with the Lord's Prayer for anybody who would care to join.